increase quite dramatically. The Asian countries are almost completely dependent on importing oil, and that sort of energy price hit on them could be hurtful, and that could slow their economies down, and thus they would slow their exports from us. In terms of energy prices, we could be here for a couple hours to talk about this one. Problem here is we believe that, if anything, it could be more of a downside risk to our forecast. We're seeing natural gas prices. We think those should start to improve as the winter ends. What we really need is exactly what's happening outside right now, and we need that to happen every day for about 2 months, or at least 3 months, given that we're around somewhere about 65% of snowpack.
Just mixing the weather forecast into...
I was going to say, Tom, I knew you were good at economic forecasts. I didn't know you were the weather guy, too.
I asked him about earthquakes this morning.
Didn't I? A little late, yeah.
Yes. This is the hindsight
for it. One for yesterday.
Yeah. Very good crystal ball he has. Swami hat on it. The way it goes, right?
One of the problems with the shortage of the hydro generation for us, too, is the possibility of rolling blackouts, production stoppages that might occur. But also you can have this feedback effect on natural gas prices might also be kept up, because then we're going to try to supplement generation through the natural gas-fired turbines to generate the electricity. And that's what's keeping the natural gas prices up right now, especially in the California area. So we're concerned about that, and if anything, we think it's going to be more of a downside risk to the forecast, if that should happen to be worse than what we're seeing right now. The stock market, this is, I think, anyone's guess, truly, as to the direction it may go in. What we're worried about is a reverse wealth effect, so that consumers start to decrease their spending relative to what we've seen, the increase in spending due to the positive wealth effect. Also, there can be a negative confidence, sort of a psychological effect on consumers, if they see the stock market as an indication of well-being. With the stock market going down, their confidence falls, business confidence falls, they start to retract on their spending. That's a U.S. phenomenon problem. That's also an Oregon problem, too. Then for the high-tech industry, I think the near term is the more downside risk. Things could be worse than what we see on the surface right now. And if that's so, that would definitely bring down our forecast. The upside risk, I think, is a little bit later on. I think really we're talking about 2003 to 2005, where it's very possible that not unlike the mid-1990s, there could be another huge increase in the high-tech sector for Oregon. With that, that's our look for the economy. And Cora Parker has the outlook for the revenue numbers.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly, members of the committee. The general fund forecast for 1999-01 is slightly increased from what we brought to you in December. We actually have brought the personal income tax forecast down, but collections in the preceding quarter were substantially above forecast. So on net, you actually have a slight increase, $18.5 million. So you're looking at just over $8.7 billion expected this biennium for personal income taxes. The corporate income tax forecast for this biennium is down by $16.6 million. That brings us below the kicker threshold, so we're no longer calling for a corporate income tax kicker. Other revenues are up slightly going into the general fund, $24.9 million. Some of that is related to a slight increase in cigarette tax revenues. Most of it is related to money from the Medicaid upper limit funds that are coming in. Many of you may be familiar with that.
How much of that is represents Mule funds?
Well, the addition is about 24.7 from December.
Of the 24.9?
Correct.
Wow.
Correct. Coming from December. I believe that's the number. It's around $24 million. And that's money that wasn't in the forecast in December that is now in there. So you're looking at an ending balance of 26.8 above where we were in December, or a total of $487.9 million. And that rolls forward into 0103, and when we get into that, I'll talk about that. But you still have a kicker. It's bigger than it was in December, and that will go out in the way of refunds in 0103. Just briefly, the lottery forecast for 9901, basically unchanged. There was an agreement with lottery to transfer at the close of session level so that they could retain revenues to replace their video terminals. That's still moving forward, so the changes you see here are basically just because of interest rates and the decrease on interest earnings to that fund. So just a slight decrease. We're looking at an ending balance of $5.5 million for lottery.
Cora, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What was the total amount of the video terminal contingency reserve in the lottery before the transfer, do you recall?
The transfer itself or the contingency amount?
Well, how much, I guess maybe I'll break it down into two questions. How much was being transferred for the purpose of the video terminals versus how much is being held in contingency?
Let me answer this the way I think I should answer it. And if it's not what you want, then I can dive into something else. But they've got just about $40 million that's being held over that without that agreement would be transferring to the state. So 580.4 is what close of session level is, so that's what's going to be transferred. There's an additional $40+ million that lottery's keeping.
Right, and that adds to an amount that they kept from the previous session for the replacement of terminals. And the total amount of that fund is how much?
The maximum that they can retain is $95 million, and I don't think they are quite at that level yet.
But they're close.
But they expect to reach it.
Okay, thank you.
Get it.
Looking at 2001-03 on page 10, again, the beginning balance is slightly up because of the revenues coming in for the current biennium. Personal income tax collections are expected to be down $137.8 million from our last forecast. Corporate income tax is down just $1.2 million, but that's it's actually down farther, but because we sort of pulled the kicker money back, there was a bit of an offset. So on net, you're only down 1.2. And other revenues are just slightly down, and that's related to cigarette tax forecasts. So you're looking at total resources of $11.365 billion, and that's on net down $113 million from December. Lottery is up from the December forecast. Transfers and other revenues, which includes not only revenues coming in, but the interest earnings, reversions, up $11.4 million. By the time you take care of dedicated distributions that also increase when resources go up, you're looking at a net increase of $6.9 million from December, or a total of $422.4 million available for appropriation. Looking at page 11, we call this our black and white chart. I know we've brought it to you many times before. It's just we use it to show what the kicker and other sort of non-economic items can do to distort growth between biennia. The white bars show what actual collections were, but the black bars show what they would have been if there weren't big refunds that were sent out. So you can just see that at times it really has a distorting effect, sending out the large refunds. And, you know, so comparing biennium to biennium is difficult looking at just that way. The state lottery resources chart below just shows that while we foresee that revenues have pretty much leveled off and will be pretty stable moving forward, there's a smaller piece that's actually not dedicated and is available for you to appropriate moving forward. And that's just because debt service has grown and the amount of dedicated distributions has increased as well. The final chart that is in your press package talks about the kicker history. It shows the size of the personal income tax kicker that we're currently forecasting is $336.7 million. That's an average of 7.9% refunds. Depending on the tax bracket that you're in, that's looking at an average refund of between $39 and $355, so pretty big range, but that's about what the averages are expected to be. Again, no corporate kicker currently expected. And not in your press packet, but something we went over this morning, and I apologize that I don't have a visual for you to look at, but we talked about what the kicker threshold was and how far we were above that. We're actually $154 million above the kicker threshold right now. So for there to not be a kicker, we would have to be off by $150-some million in the next few months. And not, you know, obviously off in a negative way, but otherwise there will be a kicker. It may, you know, change depending on how much the level of it may change, but there's a pretty sizable amount that would need to be off forecast in order for there to not be a personal income tax.
And again, that 154?
We're 154 million that includes above the threshold.
That includes the other funds, which includes the mule.
Correct.
Funds. Okay.
That is correct. Also, something we've added to the main forecast document, a blue document that you haven't seen in the forecast, at least not recently, and that's a risk section in the actual revenue discussion. And we just thought that, especially in this sort of downturn time, that it was important to mention that not only are there economic risks, and not only do they feed directly into the revenue forecast, but there are some other things that, you know, that add to the risk of the revenue numbers that we're bringing to you. The risk that Tom mentioned all feed directly into the forecast. Also, capital gains have historically been very difficult to forecast. We all know what's happened in the stock market as far as 2000 went. We have, you know, your guess is as good as mine of what's going to happen moving forward. But even knowing what's going on in the stock market, it's still difficult to understand or to get a grasp on who got out at the right time, who had capital losses, who had capital gains, what other offsetting things they have going on. So predicting what actually is going on with capital gains has been very difficult historically and difficult to look at moving forward.
Well, let me ask you about the relationship between these risk factors as they relate to the economic forecast and as they relate to the revenue forecast. Given our dependence on income tax revenue on the personal side, and of that, capital gains tax being a significant portion, where you have, let's say, if the downside risk on the economic forecast is say mild, do you have a kind of a magnifier effect as you apply that to the revenue forecast, so that a mild downturn in the stock market could result in a greater impact on the revenue side? Do you get what I mean?
I think I understand.
aren't we susceptible to more susceptible to modest changes in the market because of our dependence on the income tax and the capital gains, particularly that I'm talking about, that swings with that?
Definitely more so than other states.
Right.
We're talking about a comparison there. The fact that we tax capital gains at, you know, basically the 9% level, you know, the highest level here in Oregon, that does add some volatility to it. Capital gains is definitely a volatile component of the forecast. With respect to the other economic risks, some of them have more of an impact on personal income tax collection. Some of them have more of an impact on the corporate income tax collection. So they don't necessarily all drive into the same component of the forecast, but they do link somewhere and all have an impact.
Okay. Any questions? Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman?
For our guests. Representative Hess.
Just so I have this straight, the net May forecast comes in, like, this is down 113 million. The May forecast comes down 154 million, and that negates the kicker.
If it comes down 154 million from where we are today.
That's for the current biennium.
Correct. For the current biennium, correct.
Right.
Current biennium comes up.
Right. So we'd have to lose 154 million in 9901 for there not to be a kicker.
And that's odds are
it could happen, but...
You'd take a big earthquake.
Yeah, the consequences of which are would be really, really bad.
Yeah.
Right. If we're pulling down if we're pulling down 9901 by 154 million, then odds are you've saved yourself a kicker, but 0103 is probably also going to be pulled down by a fairly substantial amount. So.
Okay. Well, we'll hope for better news than that. Representative Bates.
A quick and simple discussion on paying the federal employees lawsuit off. How does that affect the kicker in this situation now?
Representative Shetterly and Representative Bates, currently those refunds are slated for the beginning of the 01-03 biennium. If those were to be moved into this biennium, that would decrease by $111.2 million. That's the size of the refunds that are being sent out. So that would bring this 9901 forecast down by 111.2.
But you'd still be above the kicker threshold.
Right, you'd be about 40-some above the kicker
threshold. The kicker would still kick. So you'd be out the kicker and the money.
It'd be smaller, but it would still kick. But then you wouldn't be paying those in 0103. So you've sort of offset that.
Well, it kind of depends if you're in your last term or your first term.
that's the policy choice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
I just wanted to ask a question about, we hear a lot about these startup companies and the dot-coms become dot-bombs, this kind of stuff. How much of a impact is the decline in startups affecting Oregon? Are they a big factor in our economy or a statistically significant factor in our economy, or do people get laid off here and there? I mean, here are a lot of people who lost their jobs in the last month.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, I think for Oregon, the impact is, and I maybe put it in relative terms, is not as strong as, say, in the Seattle area or in the San Francisco area, in that the sort of venture capital just is not as large here as it has been in those two areas. But it does have an impact. Lucy.com has laid off people, and we have instances of those. But I think for that industry, what we're seeing is more of a realignment. We're finally figuring out everybody got money. Now we're figuring out which are the ones that know how to really use it are the ones that are going to stay around. So I think those layoffs and so on will start to happen, but I think that's still a vibrant industry, and those people will be assimilated back into it.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we will look forward to seeing you in May. May 15?
May 14.
14, okay. And we'll wait with bated breath the confirmation of the figures, just as you have given them to us today. And I appreciate you coming, both this morning and again this afternoon. Glad to hear your report. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we will move on to the rest of our agenda. We have hearings on three bills today, all looking at income tax. That's mine. We'll start with a public hearing on House Bill 2716. Representative Rosenbaum here. Oh, there she is. Okay. That's it. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2716. And Ed, if you'll tell us what we're looking at here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2716 changes the working family child care tax credit into a refundable credit effective 2001 tax year. It also continuously appropriates amounts necessary to make refunds in excess of tax liability from the general fund to the Department of Revenue suspense account.
All right. Representative Rosenbaum, welcome back to the Revenue Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, I'm Diane Rosenbaum, State Representative from House District 14. Not quite sure about the auspicious nature of my getting to appear right after the revenue forecast. I wish I could say that I'm here in support of the bill that will solve the solution, but Indeed, I'm very glad to be before you today to be co-sponsoring the bill that you're about to hear with the chair of the committee, and also to have an opportunity to testify in favor of what I think is one of the most significant pieces of legislation you'll be considering that will actually give the legislature a chance to do some meaningful help for the economy, the employers of the state of Oregon, and some of the lowest paid working families in Oregon who really need some help, and for whom it's not just today that's a rough day, but probably every day that's an equally rough day. House Bill 2716 deals, as you heard, with the Working Family Child Care Credit, which is not a new government program. It's one that's been in place since 1997 that gives low-income working families help by allowing them to deduct up to 40% of the costs of their child care expenses. And it's actually been a very successful program, and when you look at the evaluations that have been done of it by the Employment Department, they will tell you that it has helped people stay in the workforce. It's helped employers, too, by allowing them to have a more stable, reliable workforce, and in that sense has really been a benefit to the economy of the state of Oregon. But the credit does have one very important flaw, and that is the fact that you can only deduct off of your income tax the amount of the credit that you're entitled to up to the amount that you're paying in taxes. Well, obviously, if you think about that for a minute, if you're not making very much money, you're not paying that full amount that you're otherwise entitled to in taxes, and therefore you may be getting very little benefit out of this credit. In fact, if you look at the evaluation that's done in your tax expenditure report, you see that the average qualifying family is only getting about half of the benefit of the credit that they'd otherwise be entitled to. And actually, that doesn't tell the whole story, because if you go down to the bottom end, for somebody that's really working at or near minimum wage with even average child care expenses, they are really getting very little benefit. And in fact, I think you'll hear some of this in the testimony that's to follow, that people who are at the upward end where the credit phases out will be getting about 28 times the tax relief at people at minimum wage, having exactly the same number of dependents and the same child care expenses. So there really is a needed change, and that is to make this a refundable credit, meaning that you can take the whole value of the credit and get the benefit directed to the people who need it the most, which is people with lower incomes in relation to their child care expenses. So that's essentially what the bill will do. You'll hear, I'm sure, a lot of testimony today, because I know there are a lot of people in the room who want to talk about how much this would benefit them in particular. The advocates who are in support of this are not just the bipartisan legislators that are sponsoring it, but also people who are the leading advocates for low-income people, people like the Oregon Catholic Conference, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, the Hunger Relief Task Force, I know, is here, and also advocates such as Representative Koforia, who's a member of the Oregon Child Care Commission, and they're also in support of this, as is Children First of Oregon. I guess I would just leave you with saying that I know it's a difficult day to be talking about programs that will inevitably have some cost attached, but I would really urge you that as responsible legislators and a responsive government, that really this is the right time to be looking at, if we're to make any changes in the tax system this session, we really do need to be looking at some of the people in our state who need the help, and that if there's any change that I have seen that's coming before you, this is one that really merits your serious consideration. So I hope that you will join me in being able to support it, ultimately bring it out of committee, and that we will have a chance to vote in favor of it on the floor. I think it will really be of benefit to the whole economy of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Rosenbaum? I agree, it's probably a sobering time to bring this out on the heels of the economic forecast, but I think we have to keep our eyes on the prize and maintain our focus on what we think is good policy, and hope that the stars align themselves so that when we get to the end of session, we'll have some opportunities. And that's why I want to keep looking at some of these bills that we know right now we don't have the money in the coffers to do, but we need to know what's out there so that we're ready to move when an opportunity presents itself. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Our little bill. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Bacon.
Do we know a fiscal impact, Mr. Chair?
We have a fiscal impact, nominal $56,000 for the 2001-2003 biennium revenue impact, Ed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I distributed this sheet last time we had hearings on related bills, and it includes an item making refundable the working family child care credit. Estimate, very rough estimate of the approximate annual revenue impact is $8 million, or for a full biennium, about $16 million.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
If people didn't have this, is it possible that they'd have to quit working because they couldn't afford child care for the children? So there's a physical impact there, too.
I think you will hear testimony from some people that are directly affected by this, that clearly child care is one of the biggest expenses that's faced by all families in the state, and that hits particularly hard at people that are at the low end of the income spectrum, so that there does come a break-even point where you may be paying out more in child care expenses than you're earning, and it just becomes impossible to stay in the workforce. And that's part of why I was saying that I think this really is something that will deal with the overall stability of the economy and the workforce by enabling people to stay in the workforce. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Beck.
Maybe you said this. When was this program started?
It started by the 1997 legislature and expanded actually in the 99 session, but not in this way, although a version similar to this did have overwhelming support and actually passed out of this committee and the floor of the House.
I just think this is such a modern statement or a modern approach through our world. You know, child care is so much more a part of people's lives, and I think this acknowledges that reality and just makes so much sense to people in my generation for whom child care is just reality of the world. I think a lot of people still in our society don't recognize how many people are reliant and needing of child care, and so I'm glad you're bringing this forward. A few things that are probably more worthwhile this session.
Yes. And likewise, thank you again to
yes.
Mr. Chair for
good to see you back in here.
Always good to be back here.
Yeah, we miss you. Come back. Let me bring up Marcia Kelly. Marcia, you've got to leave soon, I know, so let me invite you to come forward here.
Very, very briefly, and I don't have written testimony. My name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. We want to go on record in support of this bill. I know people behind me have much more detailed and organized testimony, but we didn't want to be left out of this one. Computers sometimes are friendly, and when your email goes down, you don't get all of your research done at appropriate times. But we did want to make sure that people knew how strongly the Women's Rights Coalition feel about this, and we are in full support of refundable earned income tax credit for working Oregonians to help them get out of the poverty level. I would point out that the University of Oregon Center for the Study of Women in Society does recommend that as one of the team recommendations.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Kelly? All right. Thank you, Marcia. Enjoy the rest of your meetings today. Patty Whitney Wise, let's bring up two or three at a time here. And is it Enid Edwards from EMO? And Jerry Tippins from Oregon Food Bank.
Chairman, while they're coming forward, I'll just make a point that if your phone ever rings and it's about 11:30 p.m. at home and you answer it, odds are it's going to be Enid.
Oh. Or when I practice law, Representative Williams, if the phone rings at 11:30, you tell them, no, don't blow.
Enid had the misfortune one night to call my home number, believing it to be my office number, about 11:30. So we had a very pleasant conversation, and I never allowed her to forget it.
Well, welcome. Patty, do you want to lead off?
Sure. You have in front of you, hot off the press, our hunger report, Hunger Headlines 2001. And if you will open up the front page of that, I'd like to just walk you through a couple of the charts to demonstrate why we are making the working family child care credit our number one priority this year. If you just look at the charts, the first one on the bottom left-hand side talks about poverty among working families with children in Oregon, which has more than doubled since 1977. These are families who are working, and yet their poverty rate has gone up significantly. And on the right-hand side, it shows how Oregon wages are lagging behind the rest of the nation, other than Idaho, which I might mention has much lower housing costs than Oregon. And the third chart shows the difference in the kinds of jobs which are now available. You have your durable manufacturing with the average earnings of $41,000 a year going down, and your service industry going up significantly, where the average wage is a little over $25,000, almost $26,000 a year. Big difference in income. Now, if you'll flip this over, I'm doing this quickly because I know you have a lot on your agenda, and I hope you'll take time to really look at this later. There is a column talking about the poverty line and that the poverty line rests on outdated assumptions. I call your attention to this because when the poverty line was put into place, it was based on the assumption that a family spent one-third of their income on food, one-third of their income on housing, and one-third of their income on everything else. Might note that there was no line item for child care in that. In those days when parents stayed home, there is no child care expense in the poverty line. So you may be above the poverty line, but you may actually be below poverty because you're paying out child care expenses. And I think that's a very important point in looking at this working family child care credit. It recognizes that this is a major expense for working families, takes a big chunk out of their pocketbooks. It makes it very hard for them to purchase food. That's why the Hunger Task Force is making this their number one priority. The only elastic item in a person's budget often is food. They have to pay the rent. They've got to pay the child care. They've got to pay the utilities. They've got to keep their car working so they can get to work and make those wages. So food gets scrimped on. We believe that this tax credit does a number of things. Number one, obviously, it assures better quality child care for children in low-income families because they'll be able to afford something decent. Secondly, it puts more expendable income into those parents' pockets. That's income that's going to go right back into your local communities and help stimulate the economy. It goes back into the grocer. It goes back into the utility companies, into the rent, all of those basic needs, the car repair. So it's a stimulus for the economy. And in an economic hard time, what more could you ask for? These are not high-income people that are going to sock the money away for a better economic time. They're going to put it right back into that local economy in goods and services. And I'd just like to end by pointing out on this report, the bottom right-hand side, the common sense provides a roadmap. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but basically what we're saying is that every family needs good quality child care, a roof over their heads, some stability so that they can give back to their community. This tax credit helps provide some of that stability for those low-wage workers. And in a way, it's that next step in the promise of ending welfare. It's helping those low-wage families, many of whom have just come off of welfare, have only been off a short time, to take the next steps forward, to stabilize their families, to move up in the job market. This is a very important investment that will help assure we don't have a return to lots of families on welfare because they can't afford to work. There's also a fact sheet that we passed out and a list of supporters, close to 100 groups. We're adding to this list daily. And I think the one thing that I'd like to end with is for you to take a look at the chart on this fact sheet, the little color box. It shows that right now for a family who has $8,400 in child care expenses, a single mom with two children who's working full-time at the minimum wage. Currently, they get $61. You can barely see it there, although her expenses are $8,400. If this credit were refundable, she would be getting $3,360. That's a big difference.
and she's the one that needs it the most, not the higher-income families. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Edwards.
You have your home number.
No, you may not.
Chair Shetterly and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. For the record, my name is Enid Edwards, and I represent Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon's public policy area. We are a voluntary association of 16 Christian denominations and some 1,600 churches across the state. We're pleased to join the many advocates in this room and across the state today in asking for your support for House Bill 2716. Our support for this bill is rooted in four principal observations. The first of these is that the bill remedies a statutory deficiency that Representative Rosenbaum described when she spoke a moment ago. Secondly, we believe that this bill is a wise investment, and I think that Patty Whitney Wise's discussion of some of the trade-offs that families face is a very good discussion of this point. I'd like to add to it that there was a recent multi-state survey funded by the Annie E. Casey Foundation and released this month by the National Council of Churches, which echoes the findings of the survey of TANF leavers done by the University of Oregon. Faith-based providers of social services in 29 states overwhelmingly noted the critical importance to family stability of state-sponsored work supports, such as child care. Our third reason for supporting this bill is that we believe it's timely. As we know, a number of policy decisions, some made at the ballot box and others in these halls, have put our lowest income families on an economic fault line. What do we know about our neighbors who earn less than 200% of the federal poverty level and are eligible for the full benefit of this tax credit? According to the Oregon Population Survey, 1 in 5 lack health insurance. That's 225,000 of our neighbors, many of them children, who lack health insurance despite the availability of federal aid. They're hungry, according to the USDA, and according to the experience of our church-based food pantries across the state. Again, despite the availability of federal aid to meet this need. They struggle with high housing costs, yet state support for affordable housing construction and rehabilitation remains relatively low. Rising energy costs loom over all of us. Meanwhile, a two-parent family working full-time at minimum wage in Oregon pays roughly 17% of their family income to keep a child in child care. Today's revised revenue forecast tells the story, and those families on the economic fault line will have little in the way of public support in Oregon as the economy shifts. Finally, and most importantly for me and for EMO, we view this bill as a part of the state's commitment to those who face the most serious economic hardships after leaving TANF. And we view with growing concern the increasing emphasis on the role of charitable organizations in the economic safety net. Our board of directors, bishops, judicatory executives, denominations, and churches we serve believe that it is wrong for the state to abandon its civic responsibility to the working poor and leave working families to forage in the private sector for assistance. Fully 40% of those surveyed by the University of Oregon reported that they had had to rely on gifts from family and friends after leaving TANF. The question before us is this, and I quote the Reverend Douglas Oldenburg, retired president of Columbia Theological Seminary in Georgia. Is caring for the poor primarily the responsibility of some of us who care, or primarily the responsibility of all of us in a just society, whether we care or not? The issue is whether people are to be made dependent on the charitable inclination of their neighbors, on the unstable and passing impulses of generosity of private persons, rather than the common responsibility of the community to which we belong. He concludes, that is where the significance of law comes in. No one can be made to depend upon their neighbor's moral qualities. In conclusion, John Stuart Mill wrote, justice implies something which is not only right to do and wrong not to do, but which some individual can claim from us as his or her moral right. House Bill 2716 is appropriate, wise, timely, and morally right. We respectfully request that you support the bill.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Tippins.
Mr. Chairman and other distinguished members of this committee, I'm Jerry Tippins, immediate past chairman of the Board of Directors of Oregon Food Bank and still a present member. I thank you very much for the opportunity to tell you why we are supporting House Bill 2716. As you know, Oregon Food Bank and its statewide network of 20 regional agencies and 771 local agencies carry on the fight against hunger on many fronts. We're probably best known for the emergency food boxes that our member agencies give out last year to 514,979 individuals who otherwise would have been hungry without the help of that emergency food box. Or you know us because of the 3 million emergency meals that we give out to people in need. But we look for, in other ways, for effective ways that we might fight hunger and that would be even more effective in certain circumstances. Most of the 500,000 people who rely on us are the working poor and their families. We look for ways to help them escape, in effect, from the emergency food box or the dependence on the emergency meal, and instead fulfill the independence promised by the paycheck. We are striving to help them stretch their budget so that they can buy their own groceries and not have to rely on a food box at the end of the month when the rent is paid and money runs out. As you know, in the last few sessions, we've been working with the legislature to spare the working poor the relatively heavy tax burden their meager incomes must bear. We believe the most helpful step that could be taken this year is to make the working family child care tax credit refundable, which is exactly what House Bill 2716 would do. Presently, the poorest of the working poor benefit very little from the tax credit. They get an amount only equal to their tax liability, so that a mother with two children, for instance, living on a minimum wage, would receive only $61 in help with child care costs, whereas a change to allow a full refund to this mother to the lowest wage incomes would contribute $3,360 toward the cost of the $8,400 child care bill. The difference would go a long way toward supporting employment and the independence that employment should bring. President Reagan addressed this issue in 1985 when he declared, and I quote, "The tax system should not be an additional burden on those who are struggling to escape from poverty. Insofar as possible, those below the poverty line should be freed from taxation altogether," end of quote. House Bill 2716 would not free them from taxation altogether, but it would give more value to the paycheck and meaning to the job. And the Oregon Food Bank strongly favors this approach and asks for your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Tippins, there you go, making this a partisan issue, invoking Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
I appreciate your testimony. Any questions of these three witnesses? Okay. Then I'll excuse you and invite up Jill White, thank you, Cynthia Morris, and Michael Fieldman. I realize you folks are not here all together, but we've got three chairs, and it just saves a little time in transition. And you can proceed, perhaps, in that order. Just wait. Did I get that right?
Wait. Yeah, wait. You have it right. Can everybody hear me? I have a very low voice and
we're okay.
A horrible sinus infection. Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jill Waite, and I'm with the Center for the Study of Women in Society and part of the University of Oregon Welfare Team. Some of you may be familiar with the study that we completed recently entitled The Oregon Families Who Left Temporary Assistance to Needy Families and Food Stamps, a Study of Economic and Family Well-being, 1998 to 2000. And what you have in front of you, hopefully, is a policy perspective pertaining to that study, and the full report is on our website, which is right up at the top of your policy perspective. This study, as I said, was carried out by the Center for the Study of Women in Society, University of Oregon, and the findings are based on two telephone interviews with a random sample of families who left or were diverted from TANF or food stamps I'm sorry, left or were diverted from TANF or left food stamps in the first quarter of 1998. And of those two phone surveys, the first one consisted of 970 families at a 12 to 15 months after leaving, and the second one was 756 families at 18 to 21 months. In addition to those two phone surveys, we also are relying on in-depth interviews with 78 families, which were conducted at 15 to 18 months after leaving, and then again 65 families at 21 to 24 months. And also administrative data from the Adult and Family Services and the Oregon Employment Department. And I just wanted to share with you just a few brief findings from the study that I think pertain to the refundable working family child care tax credit. Just to, for those of you who do have the policy perspectives, just to pull out a few, highlight some of those findings. We found that low-income families need assistance paying for high-quality child care. People who are on TANF or food stamps or were diverted from TANF have limited financial resources in the first few years after moving off welfare and into the workplace. Earnings of leavers are low, with average take-home pay 12 to 15 months and 18 to 21 months after leaving welfare at about $1,000 per month. And women's earnings are slightly lower at an average of about $966 per month, and that's at 18 to 21 months after leaving welfare. So, as has been covered already, food and shelter together consume most of these families' earnings, and many families do not even have the sufficient disposable income to afford child care expenses. We found that more than half of the families in the study paid nothing for child care 18 to 21 months after leaving TANF or food stamps or being diverted. And of these, 180 of these, which is about 24% of the families in the study, paid nothing at all for child care, also had children under 13 and were working. So they were essentially arranging unpaid supervision for the children, relying on the generosity of friends and family, okay, which, you know, people make do. It may not necessarily be the most reliable or the most high-quality daycare in many of these instances, but they do what they have to. The cost of child care interfered with working for many parents. This, I think Representative Bates refers to the question you asked earlier. Those not employed were more likely to report that paying for child care made it difficult for them to get or keep a job. And I refer you to Table 2 on your policy perspectives handout here. When asked if child care costs were a barrier to getting and or keeping a job since leaving TANF or being diverted from TANF, and this question was asked of them 12 to 15 months after leaving, 24% of the employed said that costs were indeed still a problem, and of those not employed, 31% said that costs were a problem. And when asked, were costs still a problem at that point, 47% of the employed said yes, and 79% of the not employed said yes. Okay. So child care is expensive regardless of income. Among all Oregonians in 1996, families with annual incomes below $25,000 paid on average $226 per month. Because of such similar child care costs, regardless of income, families earning more than $45,000 annually paid only 5% of their total income to child care. But those who were earning less than $25,000 were paying about 37% of their income towards child care. And families in the welfare and food stamp leaver and diverted study paid on average about $310 per month. That was in 2000. So just to conclude, we come out in support of the refundable working family tax credit to assist the lowest income families in paying the high cost of child care. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Morris?
Hi. My name is Cynthia Morris. I live in Oregon City, Clackamas County. I am here because of those two, hopefully, well-behaved. I can't see them right now.
They're doing fine.
Thank you. Not making faces or
fighting.
I'll
keep an eye on them while you testify.
I represent reality. I was here a year and a half ago as a recipient of food stamps, welfare non-working living on child support. I have since in the last year become a member of the working force. I work for Oaks Park, who supports me 100% on this bill and my being here today. Let me off early with pay. And so this is really important. Last year, I would have received approximately $948 approximately. You know, what this, how it would affect me is my son could play t-ball. You know, he wouldn't have to push, his toes wouldn't have to push out the end of his shoes. You know, I wouldn't have to say no all the time to things that children should be able to participate in, school sports. Those Pokemon cards.
Oh, don't go there.
They're evil, but we all have that. At least it's not Barney. No.
I think it'll be PlayStation.
just overall, brakes on my car, new tires, things that other people may take for granted, but I am walking in those shoes, and sometimes they get worn out. And I totally support this. I think that if nothing else, it would get some. I happen to have access to very good, reliable daycare. And you know, it would get kids back into good daycare, into programs after school. Maybe mom not having to have them be home 2 or 3 hours by themselves at night. I live in a complex where these things happen. Mom works nights. The kids are outside by themselves unattended. Things you don't like to see, but it's reality when you're in this situation. And I just think it's important. Thank you.
Representative Bates, before we go on, you got a question for Ms. White?
Wait. I was let him stumble over your. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I let him stumble over your name because I was having trouble too.
I've been doing so well.
In another committee we sit on, there's a program called Employee-Related Child Care, and another group that's concerned about child care is college students who are in college. Now, I'm trying to put those three programs kind of together in my head and how they interlock or don't interlock. Does this affect those other two programs in any way? I mean, it looks like we're targeting the same group to a certain degree. We were especially concerned about TANF people coming off TANF, getting jobs, and maintaining child care is the primary way of staying off TANF again.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned those too. Now, is this program interlock with employment-related child care?
That might be a question better aimed at someone else.
Well, I'm not trying to put you in the spot.
There are certainly programs that overlap.
Right.
And I think we talked about the employer child care tax credit. There are ways, I think, to make these things work to probably maximize their efficiency.
This is a $30 million program that's being cut that has federal matching funds in it on the Adult and Family Services side. We have an $8 million potential impact here, and I'm not sure where the college students come in at all. So I like to see those three programs together and see where we already stand on this.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, we have put off testimony today from Ellen Lowe, Bob Castagna, and Chuck Sheketoff because we'll run out of time. We'll have them back next week, maybe in a homework assignment for you guys if you want to take a look at how this might relate to some other programs that are out there. We'd be interested to know.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think it kind of proves the point that this is an issue that affects just about everybody in every walk of life, whether they're employed, not employed, in school, that it's a problem that everybody has, and there are different programs to address different people in different areas of life that are dealing with child care.
Mr. Fieldman?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Fieldman. I'm the executive director of the Umpqua Community Action Network, or UCAN, which is located in Roseburg and is a community action agency for Douglas County. Our agency provides a variety of services for low and moderate income people. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify for House Bill 2716. This legislation would be very helpful to the low-income people of Douglas County. Much emphasis has been placed the past few years on employment as a means of moving people off of welfare and out of poverty. And I think this emphasis is a very good one, but it also causes some real dilemmas for low-income people who have young children. In order to work, they need child care for their children, but the cost of child care often eats up much of their paycheck. I was listening to the president's speech the other night, and he emphasized that government should not put barriers in front of people who are trying to better themselves through work. And he also stated that government should need to reward people for working. And I agree with both of those statements, and I see this legislation as both removing barriers and providing these rewards that he suggests. It would help address the obvious problems that other people have talked about already, that many low-income people have of having to decide whether to spend their limited resources on eating, heating, housing, medical care, or child care. And these are Faustian decisions at best. This is no small problem in Douglas County. Many of the people we work with at UCAN are struggling with these decisions on a daily basis. In Douglas County, 47% of the children live in families with incomes below $25,000. Most of the working people we deal with are working for minimum wage and are working less than full time so that employers don't have to pay benefits. When you're grossing $832 a year, or $832 a month, I mean, your rent is $400 to $500 a month, and your daycare costs are $160 to $200 a month, with the remaining having to cover utilities, food, clothing, transportation, medical costs, and of course the taxes, it's clear that families quickly go in the hole or do without something. In our child care resource and referral program, about 30% of the requests we get for referrals come from low-income parents. I think this shows that many low-income parents are trying to do the right thing in getting their children into quality daycare. In our food basket programs, about 25% of the people receiving food baskets are employed, and 50% go to families with children. Some of the programs aimed at helping low-income families meet these basic needs often don't reach as many of these families as you might think. In our fuel assistance program, only 35% of our assistance goes to families with children. This is such a low number because the majority of the assistance goes to elderly and the handicapped, and we just simply run out of funding before we can get help. We can help all the families that need it. This situation will only be worse this heating season, given the huge increases in utility rates we're seeing. But needless to say, this legislation would help a large number of people better provide for their basic human needs. Besides the obvious benefit that this legislation would provide in giving people more money for basic necessities such as food, heat, shelter, and medical care, it also could have a very positive impact on another less obvious issue, and that is child safety. Our experience is that many low-income working families simply do not use regular child care because they cannot afford it. Instead, children get left at home alone, or a 9-year-old child is left to take care of a 3-year-old sibling. Or they go to a neighbor or an unemployed boyfriend who may be dealing with drug and alcohol issues or abuse issues does the child care. The reality of this situation was driven home recently when our local SCF manager commented on how many of the homes they go into on abuse reports where they find the adults are doing child care. Now, these are not the licensed and regulated child care homes, but are people who are doing this as part of the child care underground. In other words, people are putting their children into households where abuse is occurring because that is all they can afford. This is a catastrophe, I think, waiting to happen. This legislation could have a very positive impact on this situation by giving people the ability to use quality child care since it could be more affordable. We are in a state of change with the work world. We are asking people to be more responsible for themselves and to rely on the government less. In doing this, we are creating some very difficult dilemmas for low-income parents and families. This legislation could do much to alleviate some of this dilemma and really help low-income people break out of poverty, protect our children, and give people back a little bit more of their dignity by allowing them to be better providers of their families. And I hope you'll keep these perspectives in mind when you decide how to vote on this bill, and would ask that you move it out of committee. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions from Mr. Feldman?
All right. Thank you for coming. I appreciate, Mr. Fieldman, especially your travel up from Douglas County and Ms. Morris coming down from Oregon City. We have one more we'll take today, and I'm sorry, two more, I guess. Rabina Elaine Ingram Rich and David Berenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is David Berenberg, and I'm wearing my hat today of being a volunteer member of the State Child Care Commission, and appreciate that we have another member of the Child Care Commission sitting up there with you, and Representative Kafouri. And with me is Robbie Ingram Rich, who is the chair of the commission. And I'm going to take a different tact than a lot of the previous speakers who were really eloquent and moving, and unfortunately probably should have quit while we were ahead before I get to talk. But
it's not too late.
It's hard to quiet a lobbyist, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, 3 years ago, the Senate President asked the Commission, Senate President Adams, to take a look at child care funding and affordability for families. And he asked that in doing so, the Commission not assemble the usual suspects. And I think in his mind, the usual suspects were all the people who testified today who were working in the area, really see the need, but wanted to go to others who were sort of outside of human services world and to take a different look at it. So we assembled a committee that was heavy on finance, business people, and business people. The committee was chaired by, or the task force was co-chaired by a business CEO, and we began to look at all aspects of child care, and Ed Waters, your committee staff, was worked with us to crunch some of the numbers and do some of the work. And the business folks said, well, first when we look at this issue, let's look at, are there ways to lower the costs? So we provided data on child care costs and child care wages, and they all sort of looked aghast and said, people work for that little, and quickly went away from the idea that we can try to lower the cost. The next issue was, where's the hole? Who really needs it? What's the affordability problem? And we quickly came to the population that everyone was talking to today, the people who are earning too little to get tax benefits and too much to have public assistance. The next question was, well, gee, who can we get to put more money in the system? And the answers were business, and you do have the tax the other tax credit bill that you're looking at, and that is a vital component and something we thought we need to publicize more and work more with. The feds, which are putting in some more money but never enough. The state, which is really strapped and has been backing out dollars as the Fed have been putting in more, though we've been increasing the amount that's there, but it's still nowhere near enough. So that left just this hole with that population. And so this task force, made up primarily of business people, came to the same conclusion that all the others who testified here before you today, that what really is needed and will make the most difference and will really matter in the lives of those struggling in our workforce, and more importantly, too, in the lives of the children, be able to have quality experiences in child care and really be ready to learn when they go to our schools, is this refundable tax credit. And not wanting to stand between a committee and adjournment, I'm happy to stop talking there and happy to answer any questions and pass over to our commission chair.
The only thing I would add.
I'm sorry, if you could identify yourself.
My name's my legal name is Rabina Elaine Ingram Rich, and I'm the chair of the Commission for Child Care. The only thing I'd add is that this is one of the 9 legislative priorities for the Commission for Child Care in this biennium. Everything else we would have said has been said already.
Well, actually, thank you. And David, and both of you, I guess, thank you for the different perspective on this. I think this was worth hearing today, so we get a sense that there's broader support for this than just among the human services community. And not that's not good enough, but it's nice to know that there's that other people have looked at this from different perspectives and come around to the same thing.
Thank you. Sure.
Thank you. Well, committee, we are out of time, and we do have, as I mentioned, 3 witnesses yet to testify on this. We have rescheduled this bill, and the others, will those others be up on Wednesday too? Okay. The others on the agenda today, for Wednesday next week. We'll complete the testimony on this. I want to thank everybody. I guess my just parting comment on this is recognizing, again, in the context of the forecast, that this is certainly a challenge, but by the same token, if we are looking at a decline in job growth or even perhaps a recession, which is still a looming possibility out there, there is a group of working Oregonians who are most vulnerable in the event of that kind of downturn. And those are the people, I think, who are probably most going to be in need of support and probably to help maintain them in the workforce, to help keep this economy churning along. So I'd like to think that while the lines appear to be diverging, there's also a way in which they're coming together here and highlighting the need for what we're talking about today. Appreciate everybody's testimony today. We will close the public hearing on House Bill. Before I do, speaking of homework, I see that Mr. Sheketoff has given us some homework. I suppose we're supposed to have this read before the lecture. Okay. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2716, and with that, we are adjourned.
He's right to the table.
I wanted to get it up in the
answer. Is that right? Okay.
Commission, I just want to...
Let me come around there. I get yelled at. That's one of the